From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. Last month, ProPublica reported on trips made by Clarence Thomas and whether the Supreme Court justice had properly disclosed them. Now, the reporting raised questions about what kind of gifts Thomas and other justices can accept. It also raised questions in regards to judicial reform. Dr. David Adler has been digging into the history of judicial accountability, and he's planning a talk on Thursday at Boise State on the law, history, and politics around impeaching a Supreme Court justice. Dr. Adler is the president of the Alturas Institute, and he is joining us to talk more about this. Welcome to the program, Dr. Adler.
Good morning, Jim, and nice to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It is our pleasure to have you. So after the impeachment of two fairly recent presidents, we've become kind of familiar with that process of impeachment, but we don't talk much about how or why a Supreme Court justice can be impeached. So first question is, can you impeach a U.S. Supreme Court justice?
That's an important question, Hannah. Yes, the answer is yes. The framers of the Constitution, when they crafted the impeachment clause of the Constitution under Article 2, were primarily concerned with how to remove miscreant presidents and vice presidents and other civil officers. But in the course of their debates, then they turned to the question of removing judges, including Supreme Court justices, because that would be the principal way to hold them accountable. And so the criteria for removing a Supreme Court justice or any federal judge, for that matter, are very similar to those that would be applied to removing a president or a vice president, for example. We've had only one impeachment in our entire history, that is one impeachment of a Supreme Court justice. That was back in 1805, and that involved Supreme Court Justice Samuel Chase, who probably deserved to be impeached because he abused his power from the bench. He harangued his political opponents, who were Jeffersonians. He made no secret of his contempt for the Jeffersonians and told people in court that Thomas Jefferson and his party were going to bring down the Republic. But be that as it may, after he was impeached and the case moved to the Senate for the trial stage, he was nevertheless saved from removal by one vote. As you know, it takes two-thirds of the Senate to remove somebody. He was saved by the thinnest of margins.
So is the impeachment process for justices actually written in our Constitution?
Yes, it is, because judges fall under that category of all civil officers. That's how the framers regarded the justices. And of course, Article 3 provides that federal judges, including Supreme Court justices, shall hold office, quote, during good behavior. And that implies that misbehavior suggests grounds for removal. And that's when we turn to the impeachment clause to see what those grounds are. And they're familiar to many Americans, as you pointed out, after going through two recent efforts to impeach a president. Those are treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors.
So let's talk a little bit more about judicial independence, because the framers of our Constitution were highly concerned about this. And also, I mean, that's why we have three separate branches of government. We've got the executive, Congress, and we've got the judicial branch. Why, though, were the founders not just, I think, so concerned about judicial independence, but they had a faith in judicial independence that jurists would be impartial, they would be independent, they would not be political?
Well, you're absolutely right, Gemma. And that's what Alexander Hamilton told the nation in Federalist Number 78, when he informed readers that justices would not impose their own views, their own politics from the bench, that in effect, they would merely serve as a mouthpiece for the Constitution. Not everybody agreed with his appraisal of judicial behavior, but that nonetheless was the explanation. As you say, the faith in judges. And as you point out, judicial independence was critical to the well-being and maintenance of American constitutionalism. We might say that the court's ability to exercise judicial review was the framers' way of identifying the linchpin of constitutional government, that in order to check or rein in the other two branches, there was a Supreme Court standing remote, above the fray, willing to apply constitutional principles without prejudice and abstaining from the imposition of their own views. That was our constitutional faith. But of course, historically, many people, scholars and politicians and others, have at times been severely critical of the Supreme Court for engaging in politics from their perception, which would, of course, undermine the idea of judicial independence, undermine the idea that the judges are merely mouthpieces for the Constitution. And when that happens, it brings about demands or even cries for judicial reform. But all of those things point to the framers' rationale for making judges accountable through the ultimate device of impeachment. That's the ultimate way of bringing a judge to account, perhaps for abuse of power or bribery.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have over my career spoken to numerous judges, and, you know, and I would say that the what I have heard from them is when you ask them their opinion, they say it doesn't matter what my opinion is. It matters what the law is. And I mean, I know that's very simple, but isn't that kind of what our Supreme Court justices should be thinking when a case comes in front of them?
Well, you're absolutely right. That's what we expect from judges, and that's what judges of every stripe will say across America and always have across the years. There have been notable moments in our history, however, when it's been very plain that the court has deserted constitutional principles, and that's when the court makes itself vulnerable to criticisms that the judges are merely politicians dressed up in black robes. And so that's what returns us to the question of the nature of the judicial function, about which a great deal has been written over the centuries. And we certainly want judges to simply announce what the law is. At various times, as I've said, there have been decisions rendered that cause people to lose some confidence in the court. And that's what creates a profound problem here in our American legal system, because the rule of law is so critical to our success of our system. And if we don't have a lot of trust in the judicial system, then the strength of the rule of law begins to wane pretty considerably.
So let's talk about where we are today, because the U.S. Supreme Court has the lowest approval rating in its history right now. And I mean, yes, you could argue that there are numerous Americans, the majority of Americans, who are very upset with the fall of Roe v. Wade due to these justices, who many of them said it was the rule of land, they would not change it, and then they did. I think it goes further than that when we look at potential ethical issues that are happening within the court. And it is not just, you know, Justice Clarence Thomas. Does he potentially have the most egregious? Yes. But there are other justices that have not disclosed things. So there are numerous ethical issues and dilemmas facing the court right now. So how in the world does the court even move through this to a point where the general population has any faith in what they are doing?
Well, you make such an important point here, Gemma. The reality is that, for starters, the justices themselves have always conceived of their role as the principal guardians of the rule of law and maintenance of public faith in the work of the court. And so one way to restore the public's confidence is for the court to adopt a very rigorous set of ethical principles to guide their own decisions on what sort of gifts they might receive and make them make that guideline, that set of guidelines public, so that Americans can begin to hold justices to that standard. You're quite right that Justice Thomas, who has received, of course, perhaps hundreds of thousands of dollars in gifts unreported, is not the first justice to have crossed the line or come close to the line that forbids the particular gifts and amounts of money that justices can remove. We're reminded, for example, of the resignation of Justice Abe Fortas, a Democrat, in 1969. Now, it's fair to say that the kinds of gifts that Justice Fortas received, even allowing for inflation, pale in comparison to the gifts that Justice Thomas has received. But it's important to note that both Republicans and Democrats raised their concerns and leveled criticisms of Justice Fortas and called upon him to resign from the court because he had done a couple of things, including he had received a large stipend for delivering lectures at the law school at American University, $15,000 in 1968. That he could have survived that because at that point in time, Gemma, it was common for justices to receive speaking fees and honoraria for lectures. But really what doomed him and forced his removal his resignation from the court was that he had accepted a retainer from a man named Lewis Wolfson and the foundation that was going to pay him $20,000 a year for the rest of his life. And after he passed away, his wife would receive that sum of money for the duration of her life. When news broke about this, he was not only forced to resign from his nomination to become Chief Justice. He was nominated by President Lyndon Johnson, an elevation from his position as Associate Justice, but then he was forced to resign from the court. He did himself a favor, and he said the court, because he thought the court should not be subjected to the kind of heat that would be brought upon him through investigations and perhaps an impeachment hearing and maybe even a Senate trial. So he did the right thing. He returned all the money to the Wolfson Foundation and he resigned. He loved the court, but he definitely should not have accepted that money. And so when we use that as the standard back in 1969, we might wonder, should that be the standard today? And now Justice Thomas is not about to return hundreds of thousands of dollars, perhaps even millions of dollars in the value of the trips and the gifts he's received. But there's that looming question as you raise the important issue about ethics at the Supreme Court. What should be done? The only issue is for Justice Thomas to decide whether he ought to resign, whether other justices ought to have personal, perhaps confidential discussions with him, or the next step would be perhaps to bring articles of impeachment in the House of Representatives if enough congressmen think that is warranted. But I fear that the nation has moved so far beyond the days of 1969, where both Democrats and Republicans, in a bipartisan fashion, would call for Justice Fortas to resign his position. I don't think that's likely to happen today within the GOP-controlled House of Representatives.
One more question for you then before I let you go. And this is the fact that the Senate Judiciary Committee did invite Supreme Court Justice John Roberts to testify at a hearing on May 2nd. He said no, saying that, quote, it's exceedingly rare for justices to testify. Did Justice Roberts do the court any favors at all by refusing to go and be transparent?
I think he should have gone. He's quite right that it's exceedingly rare for a justice to appear before a committee. But given the low public approval rating of the court, as you cited, and given the profound mistrust of the court, I think he might have been able to do the court some real good. He might have been able to restore some faith by answering questions. If you recall, it was a year ago we witnessed the leaked opinion, messaging the downfall of Roe versus Wade. Now we've learned about Justice Thomas. There's been a raft of decisions overturning many years of precedence that has sowed the seeds of further doubt in the court's impartiality. And now I think the Chief Justice, who gets high marks for his integrity and stewardship of the court, probably could have done a very good job and helped to restore some faith in the court by taking questions.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us on this issue today. We've been talking with Dr. David Adler, the president of the Alturas Institute, about his upcoming talk. It's this Thursday at Boise State University. It's titled Impeaching a Supreme Court Justice, Law, History, and Politics. It starts at 4 p.m. Again, Dr. Adler, really nice to have you on the program again.
Great to be with you. Thanks very much, Gemma.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
What if the greatest tragedy of your life was just covered up?
I have never seen anything like that before or after.
This is the story of the worst marine-on-marine friendly fire in modern history, a story kept from the public.
It's like, what did y'all have to hide?
Listen to NPR's Embedded podcast in its latest series, Taking Cover.